saturated fat clearly does not contribute to heart disease. The majority of patients that have heart surgery and get stents, they still end up dying of heart disease. But it has effects on the heart.
Dr. Philip Pavadia,
the world-renowned heart surgeon.
A best-selling author of Stay Off My Operating Table.
He knows the cure for heart disease.
And it starts with diet.
The vast majority of what I do is preventable. We can deal with insulin resistance, which is really the main underlying driving factor of heart disease, or we can deal with your insulin resistance by me opening up your chest and performing this majorly invasive surgery. Most patients aren't really given that choice. The vast majority of people who end up taking statins don't benefit from doing so. Even if your LDL cholesterol level is high, that may not be problematic if you have the right type of LDL cholesterol. The heart really prefers ketones if they're available.
Let's play a game, which is this food gonna help my heart or destroy my heart? The first one is eggs.
Eggs I would definitely put in the helping your heart category.
An apple a day keeps the doctor away. True or false?
Apples are probably one of the worst fruits that we can incorporate. Many of us grew up hearing that we needed to use margarine instead of butter. I say that may have been one of the biggest mistakes around medicine and nutrition.
Do certain vaccines affect the heart?
I would say that that's an unanswered question, but there certainly is concern.
Imagine you know somebody that has had heart failure at age 38. Well, that was one of Dr. Ovadia's patients, and her heart failure was completely preventable. And on this health podcast, we have learned from so many of these experts that things like dementia, heart disease, and cancer is completely preventable. And that's our mission, to share this with as many people as possible. And you can help with this mission by hitting that subscribe button. This will allow more people to hear this message, to hear this episode with Dr. Ovadia, and hopefully save someone's life. Thank you. Dr. Ovadia, welcome.
Great to be here with you again, Rena.
When it comes to heart disease, that is one of the biggest killers worldwide. And Dr. Ovadia, as a heart surgeon, you've done over 3,000 heart surgeries. And even you say heart disease and heart attacks are 100% preventable if we do the right things that you outline in your book, Stay Off My Operating Table. In this episode, we're going to make sure that you're never on Dr. Ovadia's operating table. We're going to talk about the warning signs of a heart attack before it happens, the 5 metabolic markers that you need to know, and some certain healthy foods that we're eating every day that could lead to a heart attack. But Dr. Ovadia, my first question, how common is heart disease?
Yeah, so heart disease is very common here in the United States and worldwide. It is the number one killer. To give you an idea, here in the United States, someone has a heart attack approximately every 40 seconds of the day. Someone in the United States has a heart attack. Probably in their lifetime, your chance of being affected in some way by heart disease is 50%, essentially. One out of two people will have some heart disease. That may not be heart disease that kills you, but it's still going to affect your life. Heart surgery is one of the most commonly performed surgeries here in the U.S., worldwide as well. Just got out of another surgery a little while ago, and I remain a very busy heart surgeon. But as you mentioned, the vast majority of what I do is preventable. And if people were educated with the right information, and if we were able to change the environment around them, and that especially means the food environment around them, I think we could wipe out heart disease essentially pretty quickly. And the evidence for that is that heart disease was a very rare disease prior to about 100 years ago. Here in the U.S., we have the reports from the leading physicians at the end of the 1800s and the early 1900s. And they would report, essentially everything they saw during their careers. And heart disease was very rare. And it was only, you know, throughout the early 1900s that it started to increase, and then accelerated throughout the, you know, 1950s, 1960s, certainly really came to a crisis point here in the United States, and remains that way today.
So you mentioned that you just came out of a surgery. As a heart surgeon, what are the main surgeries that you're performing every day?
Yeah, so the most common procedure I do is what's called a coronary artery bypass surgery. And what this means is that someone has developed significant blockages in the arteries of the heart. So these are the arteries that are actually supplying the blood to the heart itself. People, you know, might be a little confused by this. They might say, well, the heart is filled with blood all the time. Why does it need, you know, its own blood supply? But, you know, the heart is a muscle and it needs blood, and it can't really absorb the blood that is inside of it. It needs to get blood through arteries like everywhere else in our body. And these arteries are particularly susceptible to becoming blocked up, what we call atherosclerosis. And when that disease process gets too far advanced, that's when you may end up seeing a heart surgeon like myself. So in the coronary artery bypass surgery, what we do is we basically reroute the blood around the blockages. We essentially create new blood vessels by borrowing blood vessels from elsewhere in the body so that we can get blood flow going to the heart again. Ultimately, you know, what I tell people is, you know, we can deal with insulin resistance, which is really the main underlying driving factor of heart disease, by changing the food you eat. Or we can deal with your insulin resistance by me opening up your chest and performing this majorly invasive surgery. And, you know, when you put it that way, for most people, the choice is obvious. The unfortunate situation is that most patients aren't really given that choice. They aren't educated about insulin resistance. They aren't diagnosed by their doctors with insulin resistance, and they're not, you know, taught how we can reverse it so that it doesn't get to the point of needing to come see me as a heart surgeon.
You've been a heart surgeon for over 20 years, right?
Yes.
What was your hardest patient in those 20 years that you've ever operated on?
Yeah, you know, the scenario, the patient that I open my book with, Stay Off My Operating Table, really probably was one of the most difficult days of my professional life. And this was a very unfortunate young woman, 38 years old, young children, you know, a mother. And she came to us with just a devastating cardiac condition. It's not the routine, you know, that we were just talking about. It's a condition called aortic dissection, which means that the blood vessel leading out from the heart, the aorta, had torn. And because of the way it tears, it can compromise the blood flow to the entire body, but most essentially to the brain and to the organs in our abdomen. And it's a surgical emergency. Many people die from it, and it's a devastating condition. And despite, you know, those surgeries can be quite long, and my team and I worked on that lady for over 10 hours, but unfortunately we were unable to save her life. And, you know, having to go out and talk to this family, including, you know, her young children, and try and explain to them that, you know, their mother didn't survive surgery, was really one of the most difficult things, I have to do as a surgeon. And on that day, it was, I think, particularly difficult because I had already, gone through my own transformation. You know, lost weight and recognized the importance of metabolic health, and was recognizing, you know, how metabolic health, insulin resistance are the keys to preventing heart disease. And so I knew, perhaps I realized for the first time, you know, when something like this occurred, that it really was completely preventable. And that if this unfortunate woman had been diagnosed with insulin resistance, and told how to reverse that instead of just having been given medication to treat her high blood pressure, her story may not have ended so soon.
So you're saying this woman that was 38 years old, kind of my age, the cause of her death was preventable entirely?
Yeah, aortic dissection is almost always caused by and associated with high blood pressure. High blood pressure, is almost always caused by insulin resistance. And, there were many other factors in this lady that makes me quite convinced that she had insulin resistance. Again, we now know, we have the experience that when you treat the insulin resistance, the high blood pressure is oftentimes fully reversed. You can get people off of medication. And so that approach very likely would have helped that woman avoid this devastating, aortic dissection that she ultimately died from.
So she was taking medications, perhaps for high blood pressure and maybe some other medications. Why did it not work in this situation?
Well, there can be a few different reasons it doesn't work. Sometimes patients aren't compliant with taking the medication, and oftentimes that's because the medications have side effects that make them not want to take it. But sometimes patients, for whatever reason, just don't take the medicines, and therefore, obviously, it's not going to help. And other times, the problem isn't properly responsive to medications. Perhaps the medications haven't been managed in the, as aggressively or as they could have been or should have been. But ultimately, I think the medications really fail because they don't address the underlying root cause. We're trying to treat the end effects, and we can have much bigger impact on these diseases when we actually address the root cause of the disease.
And that's exactly what you did with your own life. You addressed the root cause because you weren't a very healthy heart surgeon for a long time. Tell us more about that and how you changed.
Yeah. So, for the first half of my career as a heart surgeon, I, like you said, was very unhealthy. I had reached the point that I was morbidly obese. I was pre-diabetic, and I was destined to end up on my own operating table, so to speak. I was following that same path that so many of my patients had followed. And, like so many of them, I was at a loss. I didn't know what to do because I was trying to follow the advice that I had been educated to give. There were many times that I had done the eat less, move more, eat a low-fat diet. And, I would lose some weight, but it would always come back and more. And it was only when I, started focusing on insulin resistance, metabolic health, adopted a low carbohydrate diet, that I was able to lose the weight, maintain the weight loss now going on 8 years. And that's because it addressed the underlying root cause, the insulin resistance that was contributing to my obesity, to my prediabetes. And that has shown me the power of that approach. I was sort of my own first patient in that regards.
And we're going to talk about the lifestyle that Dr. Ovadia has currently, what he eats, how he moves, because you're a heart surgeon, you're busy. We're all busy. Is it easy to maintain that lifestyle?
Yeah, it's actually a lot easier than I think the lifestyle that it used to maintain. Yeah, there are many advantages and we'll get into that. But as a busy heart surgeon, I have my heart surgery practice. I have a telemedicine practice where I'm helping people to stay off the operating table. And then everything else. I'm a father, I'm a husband, the social media, the travel, all of the work that goes into this. Yes, I'm very busy. And one of the advantages, one of the reasons that I think this approach has worked so well is it really does make it easier. And that's sometimes hard for people to understand. They always think of diets as, restrictive, and it takes a lot of planning, and you gotta, and the reality is that, low carbohydrate and especially the the primarily carnivore diet that I maintain is actually a lot easier. I don't have to plan. I don't really have to think about what I'm going to eat. I'm hungry a lot less often. So in the past, if, you know, I knew I was going to have a long day in the operating room, I'd always be thinking about when am I going to eat, you know, what am I going to eat? And now, you know, if I'm in the operating room for a long time and I'm doing other stuff and, you know, I don't get hungry very often. So I can go long periods of time without eating and it's not stressful like it used to be.
Does the heart perform better in ketosis?
Yeah, so we do have some evidence, certainly, that the heart prefers ketones as its energy source over glucose. Now, you know, understand that every organ in our body can utilize both. But there is evidence that, you know, the heart really prefers ketones if they're available. And there are a couple of, you know, kind of lines of evidence that point us in that direction. The first thing that tells us that the heart probably prefers fat as its fuel source as opposed to glucose is there is actually a direct route for the fats that are absorbed in the intestines to go to the heart. Directly. That's actually the first place they go to, and they bypass the liver. This is through a structure called the thoracic duct. So, you know, fat kind of that gets absorbed gets to our heart first and foremost. There have been studies done on people with weak hearts, with what we call heart failure. And both animal studies and some, you know, human data that I admit is limited. But there has been benefits shown to being in ketosis or supplementing with ketones, exogenous ketones, for people that are in heart failure and in animal models of heart failure. So it does seem like the heart works better when it's running on ketones as opposed to glucose.
As Dr. Avedian mentioned, the heart and the body performs best in ketosis. And a great way to get into ketosis is to follow a carnivore diet. So if you're thinking about trying a carnivore diet, or maybe you're on carnivore, having like-minded people around you is so important. And also having carnivore doctors that understand this nutritional approach is critical to your success. And that's why I have partnered with Go Carnivore. Every week we have your favorite carnivore doctors like Dr. Sean Baker, Dr. Elizabeth Bright, and Dr. Kiltz. We also have carnivore coaches, fat loss challenges, meal plans, and a list of over 800 carnivore and keto doctors to help support you. To learn more, just go to gocarnivore.com. What causes the heart to not work well? What destroys the heart and causes the atherosclerosis or the heart disease?
Yeah, exactly. So atherosclerosis is the primary form of heart disease, and the primary cause of heart failure is the consequences of that. You know, the medical term for it is ischemia, meaning that the muscle is not getting enough oxygen to do what it needs to do. And so, atherosclerosis is the primary cause of heart disease, and the underlying root cause of atherosclerosis is insulin resistance and inflammation. And, you know, this has been demonstrated many, many times over decades of research. It's really not a controversial topic, or at least it shouldn't be, by people who know what they're talking about. Unfortunately, you know, the sort of common misconception that has been propagated, and, you know, many physicians live under this misconception, as well as, you know, people in general, is that cholesterol is the primary driver of atherosclerosis. And it's simply not. Cholesterol is part of the process that leads to atherosclerosis, but it is clearly not the root cause of it. Again, we have plenty of evidence from researchers, scientists like Gerald Reven and others showing that insulin resistance and then inflammation are the primary drivers. They are the inciting event that, you know, start the atherosclerosis process.
So if it's not cholesterol and it's not like saturated fat, and we're going to talk about saturated fat, I want to talk about the arteries in the heart, and they get plaque buildup and then they get narrowed, and then that causes a burst and a heart attack. How does that plaque actually end up there? It's the inflammation and insulin resistance, but is it the food? Is it something else that's making that plaque grow over time?
Yeah, so it certainly can be driven by food via insulin resistance. So, you know, what needs to happen first is the blood vessel needs to be damaged. There are a number of things that can lead to damage to the blood vessel. It's actually the lining of the blood vessel, what we call the endothelium, that gets damaged. So we know, for instance, that high glucose, high sugar concentrations in the bloodstream are damaging to the endothelium. And that's one of the primary drivers. There are other things that can cause damage, things like, we know that smoking, for instance, is strongly associated with atherosclerosis. And it's because many of the chemicals in cigarettes that get into the bloodstream are damaging to the blood vessels. Other things that cause inflammation are also associated with increased incidence of heart disease. So you look at people that have inflammatory conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, for instance, and we see that people with inflammatory conditions are at increased risk of heart disease. And again, this inflammation, this inflammatory process can lead to blood vessel damage as well. So, and one other that I'll throw in there is kind of mechanical stress on the blood vessels. So when people have high blood pressure, that sort of extra mechanical stress on the blood vessel can be damaging in and of itself. So those are probably the biggest, factors. But again, you need to have damage to the blood vessel first before this atherosclerotic plaque process can begin.
And is heart disease genetic? Are we born with it?
Not the common form of heart disease. And I do want to, put a little caveat on this whole conversation that there are many forms of heart disease. When we're talking about atherosclerosis, no, we're certainly not born with it. Are there certain genetic features that might make some people more, susceptible to it? Yes, there certainly are. But even if you have those genetic characteristics that might make you susceptible to it, your habits are still going to be the major determinant of whether or not you end up getting it. I do not believe, and I've never seen evidence, that there are people who are just absolutely genetically determined that they are going to develop atherosclerosis. And we can even look at something that many doctors would think makes heart disease inevitable, a genetic condition called familial hypercholesterolemia. So these are people that are born with genetic alterations, we'll call it, defects maybe, in the way that their body metabolizes cholesterol. And they end up with very high cholesterol levels, usually from very early on in life, from birth even. And when you look at those people, not all of them develop heart disease. Some of them do, and they certainly, develop heart disease earlier in some cases than, on average. But even those people are not predetermined that, no matter what they do, they're going to develop heart disease. They can still make changes in their habits that will minimize their risk of developing heart disease.
Let's talk about the five metabolic markers that you talk about in your book that is going to tell someone if they're going to get a heart attack or heart disease. What's the first one?
Yeah, so these five markers are going to tell you whether or not you are insulin resistant, essentially, whether or not you have the metabolic syndrome, and that is going to certainly predispose you to the development of heart disease. So the first marker to look at is something you can check at home by yourself, and it's your waist circumference. And you basically just take a tape measure, you measure just above the level of your belly button. And if you're a man, and I'm going to apologize because I always do this in US units, we have to convert. I know you have a very international audience, but if you're a man, you want that measurement to be less than 40 inches. And if you're a woman, you want it to be less than 35 inches.
So if it's over that, what do they need to do?
You need to reduce it first and foremost. And you probably need to get a good evaluation to determine if in fact you are insulin resistant. It actually turns out, of these five measures that we're going to talk about, when you look at each one individually, the waist circumference is probably the most powerful predictor of whether or not you might be insulin resistant.
What is marker number two, Dr. Avedia?
Marker number two is your blood pressure. Like we talked about earlier, high blood pressure is oftentimes one of the early indicators of metabolic problems and oftentimes related to insulin resistance. So specifically, you want your blood pressure to be less than 130 on the top number, less than 85 on the bottom number. Both of those should be within, the range to be considered healthy. And that should be without the use of medication. If you've already been started on medication because of high blood pressure, that's an indicator that you are not metabolically healthy.
So that is something that someone could test at home if they have their own blood pressure kit. So again, two things that you can test at home, very easy. What is the third one?
Yeah, so the final three are all going to be blood metrics. So you do need to get some basic blood work drawn. So number three is going to be your fasting blood glucose level. So again, this is the amount of sugar that's in your bloodstream when you haven't eaten for about 8 to 12 hours. And that number should be less than 100 milligrams per deciliter. So here in the US, that's about 5.5 millimole for our international listeners. And again, that needs to be without the use of medication. If you've been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, it's an indicator that you are not metabolically healthy.
Okay. And then the last two that you need a blood test for?
Yeah. So the other blood test you're going to need is a lipid panel, or your cholesterol panel, your doctor may call it. And importantly, when most people get their lipid panel done and they go to the doctor's going to focus on the LDL cholesterol, what they'll oftentimes called the bad cholesterol, although that's really a misnomer. For metabolic health purposes, we're going to look at other two numbers on that panel, your HDL cholesterol and your triglyceride level. Now, many people, again, will refer to HDL cholesterol as good cholesterol. Again, not a term that I'm really a fan of, but the reason they say that is because we know that actually having a higher HDL cholesterol level is beneficial, which again is confusing to people because they're always told, got to keep your cholesterol low. So you actually want more HDL cholesterol. And if you're a man, you want your level to be over 40 milligrams per deciliter. And if you're a woman, you want it to be over 50 milligrams per deciliter.
So when it comes to people testing the cholesterol, and I know that when people make these healthy changes to diet, they want to increase their fat, get into ketosis, that total cholesterol number can skyrocket. As a heart surgeon, should we be scared about that?
Well, the answer is it depends. Because, first of all, the total cholesterol measurement is not a very good metric for us to use. And even when you break down on the standard lipid panel to LDL cholesterol, HDL cholesterol, even that doesn't give us all of the information that we need. Ideally, I advocate for people to get what's called an advanced lipid panel. Sometimes it will be called an NMR panel, nuclear magnetic resonance. And this looks at the starts to get at what I think is the real issue at hand, And the real issue is not how much cholesterol you have. The issue is what kind of cholesterol, what is the quality of your cholesterol? Because, you know, there certainly is good and bad cholesterol, but it's not as simple as LDL is bad and HDL is good. And you really need to look at the size of your cholesterol particles. And specifically within the category of LDL cholesterol, we look at the size of those particles, and we know that the smaller, denser particles are the ones that are contributing to this plaque formation. The large particles don't. So it turns out that even if your cholesterol level, your LDL cholesterol level is high, that may not be problematic if you have the right type of LDL cholesterol, if you have a lot of large LDL cholesterol particles.
So in terms of getting those tests done and blood tests done, after you do that and you really want to know, do I have plaque in my arteries? Can you get a CAC score done?
Yeah. And before we jump to that, we didn't mention the fifth measure, by the way, which is the triglycerides. And so triglycerides, you do want to be lower. And the cutoff for a healthy triglyceride level is you want it to be less than 150 milligrams per deciliter. So we'll throw that in before we jump on. So, the blood work doesn't tell you whether or not you have disease in your arteries. The blood work can just give us some indications about, you know, whether you may have the risk factors that contribute to plaque formation. But ultimately, if you want to know if you have disease in your arteries, you need to look at your arteries. And the best way to do that from a screening standpoint is the coronary artery calcium scan that you mentioned. So the coronary artery calcium scan is a non-invasive test. It's an X-ray type test. We do what's called a CT scan, a CAT scan, and takes 5 minutes. They don't need to put an IV in you. They don't need to give you dye or anything like that. So it's very non-invasive, very quick and easy to do. And that is a great screening test to give you an indication about whether or not you have plaque forming in your arteries.
So when do you think it's right for somebody to do a CAC score versus looking at those other five metabolic markers of insulin resistance leading to heart disease?
Yeah, so I think they're, you know, I don't think it's one or the other. I think they go together. And the reason I say that is because the coronary artery calcium scan is going to show you the status of your arteries today. Do you have plaque? Do you not have plaque? How much plaque do you have? The blood markers, and, you know, I certainly would go beyond those five basic ones, but the blood markers in general are going to give you an idea of, you know, are you at risk of more plaque forming or starting that plaque formation process in the future? So you do want to look at both. You know, in terms of when is the right time to get your first coronary artery calcium scan, it's going to depend on a few factors. In general, I tell people that for men, probably around 40 years old, for women, probably around 50 years old. Women tend to kind of lag behind by about a decade from men in the development of heart disease. And that has to do with some of the hormonal changes. That's a general rule that I give people. Now, if you, for instance, have a strong family history, if you have reason to believe you may be at increased risk, like, you know, you've gotten those tests done and you found out that you're not metabolically healthy or you're insulin resistant, if you have diabetes, if you've been a smoker in the past, those are all reasons that you might want to get a coronary artery calcium scan even earlier. Ultimately, the earlier we figure out that you have plaque forming, the better chance we have of intervening before it gets to that advanced point that, you know, now you've had a heart attack, or, you know, now you're coming to see me as a heart surgeon because you might need bypass surgery.
So if somebody goes and sees their doctor and they have some risk factors for heart disease, but they haven't had a heart attack, nothing has happened, the doctor puts them on a low-dose statin or a statin. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's an incomplete approach at best, and it may be looking at the wrong problem. So again, we go back and we show that insulin resistance, inflammation, these are the root cause of heart disease. And you need to have damage being done to your blood vessels before the cholesterol can become problematic. So there are a couple of problems I have with the, you know, just take a statin approach. Number one is we know that the vast majority of people who end up taking statins don't benefit from doing so. It's just, you know, it's been shown over and over again. And so what I prefer is that we take a more targeted approach. We figure out who are the people that, you know, are at highest risk and may actually benefit from taking the statin. And these are going to be people that have, you know, insulin resistance, inflammation, and they have a large amount of the wrong type of cholesterol, those small, dense LDL cholesterol particles that we talked about. Now, even for those people, we have to understand that while statins reduce the overall cholesterol level in most patients that take them, they do a worse job of reducing the small dense particles that are causing the problem in the first place than reducing the large fluffy particles that really weren't causing the problem in the first place. So that's one of the problems with taking statins. The other issue is if you go to your doctor and, you know, you truly are at risk of heart disease and they give you a statin, yes, that's going to lower your cholesterol some, and maybe that lowers your risk of heart disease slightly, but it doesn't address the underlying problem. It doesn't address the insulin resistance. And in fact, over the long term, taking statins may worsen insulin resistance. So that's another problem I have with the statin approach. So I'd rather you get a more comprehensive evaluation. You figure out if you're insulin resistant. And if you are, you address that insulin resistance, and that is really going to be the most powerful way that we can prevent heart disease ultimately.
So what about somebody that has had an event, a heart attack, or any heart problem, and then the doctor prescribes them with SARB, which is a statin, a beta blocker, aspirin, and an ACE inhibitor? When they make changes to their diet, because I see this over and over when people do carnivore and keto and a ketogenic diet, and then they say, I'm feeling better. Do I have to keep taking this after I've had a heart problem? When can they go off those medications?
Yeah, this is when you really need to have a practitioner who understands all this and can help guide you through this, because there is no blanket answer. If you've truly reversed your insulin resistance, then there's a good chance that those medications aren't going to be of any benefit to you. But, you know, this isn't something that that people really should be doing on their own, especially if you already have heart disease. That's when you really need to find a good practitioner, who understands what heart disease is and how we can effectively stop it from getting worse. So I end up working with a lot of patients that already have heart disease of some form. Maybe they've had a CAC scan that's abnormal. Maybe they've already had a heart attack or a stent or even bypass surgery. All of that, putting in stents, doing bypass surgery, it still doesn't address the underlying cause. I'm very clear with my patients these days, my heart surgery patients these days, that, listen, I'm going to do this operation. It's going to improve your current situation. It's going to hopefully, you know, mitigate the risk of you having a heart attack soon. And it's going to improve your symptoms. It is going, you know, it has been shown in studies when it's applied properly to extend life. but it doesn't address the reason that you got heart disease in the first place. And if we don't address the reason that you got the heart disease in the first place, we're going to have more trouble down the line. The unfortunate reality is that the majority of patients that have heart surgery and get stents, they still end up dying of heart disease. They die later than they would have without the stent or the surgery, but they still end up dying of heart disease because we haven't addressed the underlying root cause. So you got to find a good practitioner who can guide you through this. And, you know, like I said, if the only answer that your cardiac doctor has for you on how I can reduce my risk is just take the medicine, you want to find another doctor, because taking the medicines don't address the underlying root cause.
Do certain vaccines affect the heart?
Well, you know, I would say that that's an unanswered question, but there certainly is concern. You know, and what I'll say in the recent experience is we know that COVID, whether you're talking about the virus or you're talking about the vaccine, COVID has effects on the heart. And in particular, there's concern that the spike protein of the COVID virus may be contributing to inflammation in the heart, accelerated atherosclerosis. So, you know, we've certainly seen reports of people, you know, that had no evidence of heart disease, and either they got COVID or they got the COVID vaccine, and, you know, they seem to have this accelerated atherosclerosis, myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart muscle itself, was associated, again, with both the vaccine and, you know, the COVID virus itself. Many other viruses, by the way, have also been shown to cause myocarditis. So this wasn't something that was unique to COVID. It just seemed to be perhaps more prevalent with the COVID virus versus other viruses. You know, there are a lot of unknowns, I'll say, about, you know, vaccines and really anything that you're putting into your body. We have to realize that some of these things are not tested as well as I think they could or should be. And especially, you know, again, when we look at the COVID vaccine, for instance, and it was, you know, kind of rushed to market. And, you know, we sometimes, when we do that, we don't pick up on some of these effects that only show up later on. So, you know, I certainly am not going to tell people, you know, don't get any vaccines or don't get certain vaccines. These are all decisions that you need to make, you know, with your doctor, with your medical professional. But we should be open to having that conversation. You know, the thing that concerned me most about the response around COVID and the release of the vaccine, and even today, you know, here we are years later now, and there still isn't the open scientific conversation that needs to occur as to whether or not, you know, we may be seeing problems related to these vaccines. And of course, many very prominent physicians were, you know, kind of deplatformed, suppressed, even punished for bringing up these questions, which are very valid questions.
Absolutely. And I think it's important to have the truth because it is our heart and we want to protect it by any means. And that goes into what we should be eating or maybe not eating, because there are certain foods that I think people eat every day that they think that is definitely healthy. I have to eat this because that's protecting my heart. At least that's what I hear from my mom every day. And I say, no, mom, that's not right. Let's play a game, which is this food going to help my heart or destroy my heart? The first one is eggs.
Eggs, I would definitely put in the helping your heart category. And again, you know, people get confused because there seems to be a new headline every week about eggs. But eggs are one of the most nutrient-dense and nutritious foods that we can eat. And I would put them in the category of helping your heart.
And as a heart surgeon, how many egg yolks can one eat a day?
I'm not sure there's a limit to that, you know. This heart surgeon on most days probably gets three or four in. Ultimately, eggs aren't causing any damage to your heart. So I really wouldn't put a limit on how many you can eat.
Okay. What about apples? An apple a day keeps the doctor away. True or false?
I would put that in the false category. And, you know, this is always a controversial subject. Of course, many of your audience are carnivores, and then there's always the debate about should we be incorporating fruit into our carnivore diet, which certainly some carnivore influencers have suggested. I would say two things. First of all, if you are going to incorporate fruit, I think apples are probably one of the worst fruits that we can incorporate because they tend to be just loaded with sugar, especially the way that they've been sort of, bred and engineered these days. Whether or not you can tolerate an occasional apple is going to depend on whether or not you are insulin sensitive and metabolically healthy. And this is an example of where a tool like a continuous glucose monitor can be so useful because, yes, if you are not insulin resistant, if you are insulin sensitive, and if you're active and you have a good amount of muscle mass, one apple isn't going to harm you ultimately. But for the majority of people out there who are not in that situation, they are insulin resistant and they're not active and they don't have good muscle mass, then sugar in any form, whether it's coming from an apple or whether it's coming from, the soda, your body cannot handle. And so that apple is going to be damaging for you.
Okay. Butter.
Butter is another food that I think is heart healthy and should be widely, its intake should be widely encouraged. This is something that has been demonized over the years. And of course, many of us grew up hearing that we needed to use margarine instead of butter. And I put that I say that may have been one of the biggest mistakes that have been made around medicine and nutrition telling people to eat margarine that's loaded with processed fats as opposed to eating the natural fats that are in butter very well may have significantly contributed to the epidemic of metabolic disease that we're dealing with today.
Margarine, really?
Yeah, margarine is, I think, is one of the worst things that we can eat. And unfortunately, was consumed in such large quantities because that's what everyone was told was healthy for them.
And then the saturated fat in butter is healthy for us, right?
Yes, yes. Saturated fat, understand that the scientific debate around saturated fat, yeah, I would put it in the settled category that saturated fat clearly does not contribute to heart disease or any other disease, honestly. It's just in the public conception, and that includes doctors, still hasn't been answered. But realize that, we now have multiple meta-analyses, which are, summaries of studies that show that saturated fat is not harmful. The interventional trials, which are, kind of the better type of science that we can do looking at saturated fat, have consistently shown them not to be problematic. It's just this, this really started as a hypothesis that was elevated to the, to the point of truthfulness before it was ever proven. And then when all of the subsequent science really failed to prove it, this myth has continued to persist, unfortunately. So people should not fear eating saturated fat. And there is really no evidence that saturated fat is harmful to our health.
Well, what about coffee?
Yeah, so coffee is probably one of the most controversial foodstuffs, maybe second to eggs. It seems that, you know, every week we have the study that shows coffee is good, coffee is bad. Ultimately, I think the totality of the evidence points us towards coffee not being harmful. Now, there are two caveats that I put on that. Number one is, if we're talking about just drinking coffee, black coffee, that is a lot different than how most people consume coffee. And if you're consuming coffee that's, you know, loaded up with sugar and flavoring and sweeteners, that certainly is going to be problematic. The other thing I tell people about coffee is if you need coffee, that's an indicator that something is not right in your body. So if you are tired and lack energy, and the only way that you can make it through your day is by consuming, you know, caffeine in general, but, you know, coffee for most people, that's a problem. And that's a problem that you should be looking into. If instead you consume coffee because you enjoy the taste of coffee, and I put myself in that category, then no, we really don't have any evidence that coffee is bad for our health. And I think that coffee can be consumed without concern. Like I said, as long as you're just drinking coffee and you're not using your coffee as a sugar delivery mechanism.
Okay, maybe I should rethink my black coffee in the morning. I need it to wake up. Okay. What about red meat?
Yeah, so this again is the big one. And red meat, historically, and I think if you took a survey of people and of doctors, the majority would say that red meat is harmful for your health. But again, we have the studies that disprove that. There was, again, a large analysis done on the overall impact of red meat, specifically on cardiovascular disease, as well as on cancer, which are the two things that it's most commonly associated with. And those analyses both showed that there is not any evidence to support that. And ultimately, red meat is the most nutrient-dense food that humans can eat. It is the primary food that we've been consuming for our for the vast majority of our existence as human beings. And so I put red meat firmly in the heart healthy category, and I do encourage its intake as part of a heart healthy diet. And that, of course, goes against all of the advice that we've heard for our entire lives. But it is the reality of the situation.
Absolutely. What about honey?
Yeah. So honey, similar to apples, I think, you know, if you are metabolically healthy and you're insulin sensitive, it's probably one of the, you know, best forms of sugar that we can consume. Because, honey is actually a fairly complex food. It's not just sugar as people think. But again, if you're not metabolically healthy, if you are insulin resistant, then sugar in all its forms, which include honey, are going to be problematic for you. So that's where you need to figure out what your situation is. Again, these are situations that I love using continuous glucose monitors for, because I tell people, if you really want to know, put on a continuous glucose monitor. Try the food and see what happens. That is really going to inform us of how your body is handling that food.
What about good quality salt? Is that good for people's heart?
Yes, I think it is good quality salt. The minerals and electrolytes that are in it, I think, are important to good health. So I do encourage its use. There has, again, this common misconception that, eating too much salt is going to cause your blood pressure to go up. It can contribute to it in the setting of insulin resistance. And the other kind of important thing to understand here is the studies that have shown that have never really looked at pure salt. The vast majority of the salt that people get in their diets, consuming standard Western diets, is salt that is in processed food. So, you know, really, when you look at those studies, it turns out that salt is just really a marker for processed food intake. And the salt that's in processed food is going to be a lot different than your high quality salt that you might be putting on your steak. So I don't discourage good high quality salt intake, but I do discourage salt as part of processed food.
Okay. So last one, as a heart surgeon, do you think that plants are trying to destroy our heart and our health?
You know, I don't think that plants are trying to destroy our heart and our health. I think that there are problematic aspects of plants. Certain plants might be worse than others. And again, I think this is contextual. You know, do I believe that carnivore, a plant-free diet, is the best approach that we have to good health? Yes, I do. But I don't think that everyone needs to be on a 100% pure carnivore diet. I think there are clearly situations where plants are problematic. And I usually point to, you know, people with autoimmune conditions in particular. I think that people that are not metabolically healthy, you know, again, you have to be careful. The best way to deal with insulin resistance and poor metabolic health is a as low as possible carbohydrate, you know, you're keeping your carbohydrate intake as low as possible. And so, you know, many plants contain significant amounts of carbohydrates. And I don't subscribe, I don't believe there's really any evidence to support this thinking that fiber as a carbohydrate somehow negates its effect, you know, the sort of net carb game that gets played. Not a big fan of that. And so, you know, I don't think plants are going to be harmful to all people. I think they can be harmful to some people. And what I really try and get people to understand, though, is that plants are not essential to the human diet. And they're not essential to health. And this concept that, you know, you need to eat 5 to 7 servings of vegetables a day is really just rubbish. You know, it turns out when you look at the science, what we really have shown about, you know, eating vegetables is that if you're eating a vegetable instead of a processed food, that's going to improve your health. And I wouldn't disagree with that. But there really is nothing that shows us that plants, vegetables, and fruits are essential to our health. And of course, you and I both know that the carnivore community continues to grow and thrive. And to my knowledge, none of us have come down with scurvy or any of the other supposed deficiencies that we're going to come down with because we're not eating our veggies.
Absolutely. Another myth, apart from diet and foods, is exercise. So let's just say that somebody's like, okay, I want to protect my heart, don't want to have heart disease, don't want to have a heart attack. I need to do exercise. Why is cardio, you say cardio is kind of a waste of time and it's not great for weight loss. Why is that?
Yeah, well, why is that is because, first of all, you know, again, this has been shown over and over again that cardio isn't an effective weight loss tool and really does not contribute in any way to long-term weight loss. And, you know, I think there are a couple of reasons why that is. Some of the body's adaptations is if you go and you do a strenuous, you know, cardio session, and yeah, you burn some extra calories perhaps during that session over your baseline, but your body is going to make it up elsewhere, you know, by kind of burning less calories when you're not exercising. I tell people that cardio is not an effective weight loss tool. It doesn't mean that cardio doesn't have other benefits. So, you know, the heart is like any other muscle. If you want to make it stronger, if you want to keep it strong, you need to use it. And cardio is a way of doing that. And so, you know, it can be beneficial in that regards. However, when people are, you know, if people have a limited sort of budget of resources, and by that I mean time, you know, effort, and maybe money factors into this as well, that they're trying to figure out, you know, how to get the most bang for their buck, so to speak, from their exercise, building and maintaining muscle with resistance exercise has much more powerful effects than cardio does. So ultimately, I tell people resistance exercise needs to be your priority. If you then have, you know, the resources to expend and you want to do cardio as well, fine. But more important is probably just being more active throughout your entire day. Because one of the other mistakes that I see plenty of people making is they'll go to the gym for the hour, they'll do the cardio, treadmill, bike, whatever it is, but then they'll sit around kind of doing nothing the rest of the day. And that is, you know, not going to help things. So find those little ways that you can be active throughout the day. You know, things like taking the stairs instead of the elevator or the escalator, you know, every hour, if you do have a desk job that you're sitting at your desk, get up every hour and take a 5 to 10 minute walk, you know, around the building or you know, inside your building if maybe the weather isn't conducive. Go up and down the stairs a couple of times. Do something to just get that extra activity sprinkled throughout your day, and that's going to be more effective than, you know, dedicated cardio sessions.
Absolutely. Very, very simple advice. To end the episode, I wanted to ask about warning signs for people that might be thinking, am I going to get a heart attack? I'm worried. What is the main warning signs that they might be having a heart attack so that they know what it might feel like around the body?
Yeah. So the biggest warning signs are going to be if you are developing chest pains. And these are pains that are going to be primarily focused over the left side of your chest. And they come on when you exert yourself. And then they go away when you rest. That is the biggest telltale sign of heart disease. And people will talk about the pain going down the left arm oftentimes, sometimes going up into your neck. That's, you know, the most obvious and concerning sign. Other signs that can go along with heart disease are, you know, getting short of breath when you exert yourself, getting tired more easily when you're trying to exert yourself. These can all be signs of heart disease. But again, my biggest message to people is don't wait until you have these signs, because all of those things occur when heart disease is far advanced. We can diagnose heart disease at its earliest stages with something like a coronary artery calcium scan. And we can even figure out if you're at risk for the heart disease before you get any heart disease by measuring, by looking for insulin resistance. So that really needs to be people's focus so that we can keep you off the operating table ultimately.
Well, I think if they listen to this episode, they're not going to be on your operating table, Dr. Ovedius.
I hope not.
So if people love you, want to find you more, where can they find you?
Yeah, so I'm at iFixHearts everywhere. So on all the social media, I'm at iFixHearts. You can go to iFixHearts.com and you can find out all the ways that my team and I work with people. I have a telemedicine practice. We see people throughout the U.S. and internationally. It's myself. I now have a nurse practitioner, two wonderful health coaches that work with me, and the team is actually expanding to keep up with demand. And besides the medical practice, we have coaching programs, we have courses that people can take, and of course, you can start with the book, Stay Off My Operating Table, which really gives you the guide and the master plan for everything we do with people.
I hope you enjoyed this interview. Now you need to watch this video next with Professor Thomas Seyfried, all about how to reduce the risk of cancer with diet. I'll see you guys next week.